Next case will be 065144. Bulldog v. United States.
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Rones from Boston and I represent Frank Bulldog. The district court relied on one case to support the fact that the claim had already accrued before the certificate of innocence was obtained. That was the Veltman case from 1997. And in its conclusion, the court says, the court concludes following Veltman, the claim first accrued before the certificate was obtained. Now, it's true that that was, as he says, the one opinion on point, on his point. All the other cases went the other way. And even that case, arguably, isn't on point. It was a situation where there was a filing without a certificate. And the court said, well, we'll hold this. We'll stay things and let you go back and get your certificate. So it's not very good authority for the fact that there wasn't a jurisdictional issue. Then we have the Humphreys case, and I'm not citing it as precedent because it's an unpublished decision of this court. But as I understand it, I can still point to the analysis made in that case as helping us on this issue. In Humphreys, this court mentions jurisdiction several times. There is no dispute in that case where it's coming from in regards to that particular issue. Now there's a district court case of Humphreys that was upheld. Now, I think that's still good law, and I can cite it. It wasn't overruled, but I think we can still look at that case and use that as precedent, although I'm not completely sure on that one. Now, as to the other cases involved on this issue, there are several beside Humphreys. You have Deathless versus U.S. 2001. The most fundamental requirement in the scheme is the certificate of innocence. And there's an attempt to separate out different portions of the statute, to read them independently. You have the first section that outlines what's necessary to put in the complaint. And then there's another section that describes the certificate of innocence. And the government would like to separate those out and not read them together as a unit.
Wasn't the government's liability here fixed when the order to release him from prison was executed?
No, it wasn't, for several reasons. One is that order simply said there was new evidence. There was no mention of not guilty. He simply said there's new evidence, so I'm going to vacate the conviction. But that aside, you have the certificate of innocence that's absolutely quiet. There's no other method of proof. All the cases talk about jurisdiction. This court would throw it out. They suggest it would have to throw it out under the precedent, because it doesn't make sense not to have it jurisdictional. It's a waste of everyone's time to go in there. So they have a problem even in the beginning in relying only on that vacation by the district court judge. He didn't say he was innocent. He didn't say he didn't, by his own actions, not bring it about, and that's a necessary part of the claim. So he was a long way from being in any position to file a claim in the court of in the court. Now there's another grounds why this case should come out in our favor. And that is, you have a statute that says that, and it's 1500, that says that if you have a claim pending on the same issue in another court, as we had in the U.S. District Court in Massachusetts, then you cannot file in the another court, federal court. And so we couldn't have filed, for some 2.5 years in the Court of Claims on the compensation for wrongful conviction.
But as the Court of Federal Claims pointed out, there were several periods of time during the 6-year statute of limitations window where you could have filed, where there weren't pending proceedings before the district court.
But the statute has to be read together with the statute of limitations statute. And it's very specific. You cannot file during that period. So those are 2 years when, or at least 2 years when you can't file.
So are you contending then that during the pendency of the proceedings before the district court, you add up all of that time and you tack that on to the 6-year statute of limitations and you get credit for that? Because
you couldn't file before. And that's what the cases say. The key case on the point, there's several cases. The Ball case from 1956 was overruled. And all the cases after that have said it does toll. So Bianchi's the most recent case from 2005, Bianchi versus the United States. And it states that the recent case law has trended towards the position that it does stay. And it makes sense that it does stay. The 6-year statute
well,
it is...
would be told if there was a proceeding pending at the time, of course. That's the only way you can read Section 1500. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you tack on the period of time where there were other proceedings pending.
Well, common justice would say that you should be allowed... If you're not allowed to sue during a certain period, then you don't really have the full 6 years involved. Are you saying that we shouldn't have filed in the federal court on 1983 against the law enforcement people? You're basically saying, well, we shouldn't have filed there because then we're going to lose our 6 years in going to the other court.
All I'm saying is that there were periods of time when those proceedings were not pending, when you could have filed in the Court of Federal Claims without offending Section 1500.
Oh, that's correct, but I think that's a difference without a meaning. It doesn't really go to the issue. You don't have to get into the equitable issue. This is a matter of statute, reading two statutes together and interpreting those statutes. And in fact, what were we supposed to do? Go into the Court of Claims claiming innocence and not being able to go into U.S. federal court in Massachusetts on a 1983 claim? We would have had to wait until this matter was resolved. So is it fair to take away some of the 6 years simply because we decided to go into the U.S. District Court first, which makes more sense, I suggest.
Let me ask you about your other theory, which is this theory of constructive transfer.
I think I'll rest on the brief for that one. I was brief in the brief, too.
Well, there's possibly good reason for you to be brief on that.
So I guess I've saved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. As Judge Barrett put it, all events had occurred to fix the government's liability at the time that the District Court vacated the conviction of Mr. Bullock on June 9th. Accordingly, at that point...
Well, you say that all events have occurred to establish the government's liability, but the language of 1495 says that liability is established when the conviction is reversed or set aside on the ground that he is not guilty.
Yes, Your
Honor. On the ground that he is not guilty.
Yes, Your Honor.
You attached to your brief the actual order of Judge Curra.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which doesn't say he wasn't guilty. It says that somebody else confessed to the bank robbery. It says the government has satisfied the court that somebody else did not have contact with Mr. Bullock. You might infer from that not guilty. But what he goes on to say is, the court is satisfied that convictions and sentences must be vacated based upon the discovery of new evidence. Newly discovered evidence doesn't mean that another prosecution cannot be attempted, does it?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. However, in this case, if you read the remainder of 1495, I'm sorry, 2513A1, it says, as appears in the record. And the record wasn't just this order. This record also included the fact that there's a habeas request, which is what led to this order. And the government's response to that included a statement that this person is factually innocent. And we know that.
Is that record in this record?
The one part of the record that is in this record, again, because we're talking about what was filed with plaintiffs, then plaintiffs, now appellate, complaint, was the letter from the U.S. Attorney in which he quoted a portion of the government's response.
Of a motion that he wrote, in which he said exonerates the petition.
Yes. In fact, if you look at Supplemental Appendix page 4, that's the appendix at the end of the government's brief in this case.
But does that motion, a lot of motions are filed for reasons that are not adopted by trial courts.
Indeed, Your Honor. But I think the only way to read this, again, it's based upon the record, as is apparent from the record. And what's apparent from the record here is the trial court didn't even feel the need to have a follow-on hearing as it had been scheduled. The government all along said, we admit, when it responded to the habeas petition, that yes, this is a person who's actually innocent. We're very sorry.
It's pretty clear that everybody thought he was innocent, but the 6-day missing the statute of 6 days by 6 days is pretty technical. It seems to me technical ought to apply to both sides here.
It does, Your Honor. But again, the question is, have the government's liability been fixed? And the answer is yes, because it appears from the record that the person was in fact not guilty. Anybody reading this record,
somebody might infer from the record.
The statute states, as appears from the record, and that is the test. And as appears from the record can only be read, in this case, to be that this person was innocent, factually innocent. There's no other way to read the record when you conclude the whole record, which is before the district court.
I think we understand each other at that point.
Indeed, Your Honor. And of course, I misspoke, I said June 9th. I mean, June 11th, of course, is when the district court set aside his conviction.
Upon motion of the defendant.
Yes, Your Honor.
Didn't do it sua sponte.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Absolutely not. Upon motion, and with the government's concurrence, and with the government's, in fact, providing evidence to support the setting aside. Because, as you can tell from the district court's order, it said that all the government response doesn't include an affidavit. We're satisfied that the facts are such that it supports the immediate release of this individual, which is what the district court did. Accordingly, on this date, June 11th, the facts were set, so the government's liability was set. It wasn't going to go any larger, and at that point, following Welker and other cases, Gowalty, for example, Mr. Bullock could have filed a complaint in the Court of Federal Claims. He would not have been successful until he had obtained a certificate of innocence, but government tells us we don't have to actually have that in our hands when we file a complaint seeking payment for an unjust conviction, as is the case here. In terms of the issue of whether or not there should be equitable stop in this case, equitable tolling, this court has never held that Section 2501 is subject to equitable tolling. Moreover, there's good reason to believe it shouldn't be subject to it, because there are exceptions, particular exceptions. For example, a person is across the seas, as is in statute, or is legally incompetent at the time to proceed. Moreover, in order to obtain the advantage of the equitable tolling, you must have followed your diligently your legal matters, and there must be some sort of, the language is, extraordinary circumstance standing in the way. Section 1500 was not an extraordinary circumstance standing in Mr. Bullock's way. First of all, there's no indication whatsoever that Mr. Bullock was withheld, held up by Section 1500. He didn't even cite it until the trial court, sua sponte, brought it up. And second of all, as Judge Lynn has brought forward, there were several occasions and times that Mr. Bullock could have filed his lawsuit in Court of Federal Claims, therefore not bringing a file of 1500. So he could have pursued both, be just done in the right order, and there is no reason, no compelling reason whatsoever, that he should otherwise be told. Unless the court has any further questions. The trial court's decision should be heard.
Okay. 2513 says that the claimant must allege and prove. And the certificate of innocence is one of the things that is required. So the statute itself is saying allege. The plaintiff would be lying to the court if he said he had a certificate of innocence when he didn't. Who knows he's ever going to get that certificate of innocence? He might believe that he's innocent, but that's not the issue. A lot of my clients believe they're innocent. And some of them are, but that's not the point. You have to have a finding by a judge to that effect.
Let's take the back end of the argument that we just heard from government counsel. The record that is before us says that the judge specified, in his order, June 11, specified the conviction was vacated because another individual with whom Bolduc did not have conduct verifiably confessed to the commission of crimes. That doesn't all completely mean that he's exonerated, but 2 days before, the U.S. attorney had filed a motion saying that the facts exonerate your client. Now, does it, with that and nothing more, I think we have nothing more of record, does that make it appear from the record that he is not guilty of the offense of which he was convicted?
Well, I think you have to have a not guilty finding. That's into the statute. I mean, it just says you have to have a declaration of not guilty. All this said was the trial. He has a right to a new trial. And as you pointed out, technicalities. That's a way of getting around the technicality. And then they want it both ways, of course. But I think that's an issue there. But the issue of the certificate of innocence, I don't know how we get around that. Humphreys in the district court said, or in this court, and though it's not precedent, it's dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, period. There was no proper certificate of innocence. And that makes sense. Why are we wasting everyone's time? Does this court want people to file suits, every prisoner in the land, and say, I'm innocent, and I'll bring in the evidence later, because it's a matter of proof? I mean, it doesn't really make sense, and the courts have recognized that. And what about death threats in 2001 from this court? The most fundamental requirement of the statutory scheme is that it be a certificate of innocence before that case can be entertained. Is my time up?
It's your wife calling.
Well, I'll wait a while now. And then you have the Lucas case, going back to 1981. So this isn't something that's come out of the wall just recently. And they said you need, will not entertain a claim. And they try to distinguish this on the grounds that, well, it was a pro se claimant, and he hadn't established his not guilt beforehand and this and that. But that's all the specific fact, the specific case, and doesn't go to the fundamental issue. Did the claim accrue? And it accrues only when there's no obstacle to filing that claim, when everything necessary to filing the claim is in place. And there are other cases apart from this statute dealing with this issue that I've cited where the court has not allowed a suit. For instance, if you owe a debt, you can't sue until the other side has refused to pay the debt. So I'm getting near the end of my time here. I'd also make reference to Brown. That's another case that supports our position in this regard. Thank you.
Thank you very much.